All right, so I want to get moving here tonight. We spent the first 2 weeks of this study basically talking about a biblical philosophy of money, that having an attitude, well, money is a thing of the world and we're not supposed to be worldly, so we don't need to make money, we don't need to manage our money. That doesn't really make us more spiritual, that just makes us unwise. We know that the Bible has so much to say about the manner of the matter of finances and how we are to handle them. So I want to do two things here tonight. The main thing that we're going to talk about is work and biblical principles of work, and then some practical things to keep in mind for our career as we're working that are things we could pray about that God would help us see. Are we being wise in the way that we handle making money? And also the biblical command that we be hard workers. But I wanted to start here tonight just by throwing this up here on the screen and mentioning it briefly, and then we'll move on. I asked last week, had anybody ever heard of Dave Ramsey? And a few of you raised your hands. So I think he teaches a system over the last 40 years that is very wise, that has a lot of biblical principles. So I want to say them briefly and just kind of keep them in mind. And tonight we're going to talk about work and income. When we go forward, we'll talk about debt and spending and budgeting and giving and a lot of those different things. But before I read this slide, I want to say a couple things. I said, if you've not heard of him before, or if you've very briefly interacted with him, the older he's got, the grumpier he seems to be, that if you barely tune in tonight or you've looked another time at his YouTube channel, he might come across as just somebody who's yelling at you because you're not doing good enough. And I don't know, it seems to happen with people when they get older in a lot of different ways. Some people, I'm just, not everybody, I'm just saying. But the other thing I wanted to say is this isn't a Financial Peace University class, though I would highly recommend that resource. And I'll have some resources printed up in our study notes at some point. And I don't do his system perfectly, but he has 7 basic steps that if you did them would be a very wise way to handle your money. And the Lord would bless you in the long term. It's a very simple plan, but it's not an easy plan to follow, especially the way that things, the costs have gone up so much, depending on where you're at. So it's simple to understand, but might be difficult to carry out. And there's a lot of questions that would come to your mind. But this is just a simple, basic outline of a plan that is somewhat biblically based, that he teaches people who come, who say, we need help with our finances, we're in debt, we're upside down with our budget, what do we do? So 7 steps. The first one is you save $1,000 and put it in an emergency fund so that that money doesn't get touched unless there's an absolute emergency that doesn't pop up in your reoccurring monthly expenses. So like a car breaking down or something, but going out to eat wouldn't be considered an emergency. So people will say, well, $1,000 isn't enough, and it's not, and he hasn't changed that number in like 20 years. But the basic idea is you keep a little bit of money you don't touch, and the rest you're going to use to get out of debt and get set up for a good future. And he says he puts it that low because he wants you to feel panicked if you're deeply in debt or you have things that you need to clean up so that you can get ahead and win for your future. So you save $1,000, and the next is you start trying to pay off all debt that's in your name, and you'll see it says there except for the house. Looking at if you have a mortgage, it's more of an investment, and it would really disrupt your long-term plan if you threw everything at your mortgage every month before you were trying to save and invest. So the way he teaches it is to do a snowball method, which means you take the smallest debt you have other than your house and you knock that out first. So if you have $500 on a credit card and that's the lowest amount you owe, you pay all your minimums, but everything extra goes to the $500 card. Then you start trying to pay off the lien on your house, that's $5,000, all the way up, your cars, all of that type of thing. When you're able to pay off your debt, you save a real emergency fund, which is 3 to 6 months of expenses. So that would be you figuring out not vacations and all that, but paying my mortgage, paying my insurance, my phone bill, and buying rice and beans at the store. If I lost my job or if I broke my leg and nothing was going to cover it, could I have 3 to 6 months saved that I'm not investing? That's basically like an insurance policy so that if something goes wrong, you have something in reserve. And again, I'm going to come back to all of these in a long roundabout way throughout the summer, but it's just wise planning because something's going to go wrong. There's always a pandemic. There's always an injury. There's always a job layoff. There's always something coming around the corner that if you're more flexible with having paid off your debt and having a little bit of money saved, it doesn't knock you into a crisis whenever anything comes up. Then he says you invest 15% of your income towards retirement. So that would be something like the 401k, something like the Roth IRA. If your work provides it, even if your work doesn't, you can do that yourself. And if you didn't do the whole 15%, I'm going to get to eventually show the models, but go home and pull out a compound interest calculator and put $100 a month and run that for 30 or 40 years. You will, unless the entire U.S. economy turns to trash, which of course it might, but if that happens, then all of our plans are out the window anyway. So it's kind of like saying, well, we don't fail to plan for the future because something bad might happen. We should look at it as our faith is in God, not in the U.S. dollar, but still do something that if this country continues as it usually does, that when we're 70, 80, our bodies are giving out, we could have something set aside that we could live off of, that all the pressure doesn't go to our kids or just to whatever the state is offering or the church that might be able to help us out. So if you go home and take a compound interest calculator, put in like $100 a month for 40 years, it comes out to easily over $1 million, which again, that's based off of the history of the stock market and what it's always done. So I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'm just saying the thinking behind this sort of plan is you're saving, you're paying off debt, then you're saving a little bit more, then you're investing. The fifth one is you save for your children's college. If that's something you're interested in doing, what is it, the 529B or those type things that are tax deferred, if it's important to you, you can start saving when they're young in a way that will pay off in the long run. Step six would be if you're doing all those things and you have extra money, then you can pay off your house early. And once you get past that point, you're basically just accumulating wealth from your investments and your income, and you're able to give more than you've ever given. And I do believe he tells people at all steps of it, if you're a Christian, give. He talks about freely the tithing principle that we might talk some about that throughout this series and how people argue about that. And is it law? Is it grace? Is it command? Is it voluntary? Whatever the case you want to say and believe there, and I can give you some of my thoughts. It's a principle that Christians have carried out for centuries, looking at the Old Testament example and saying, if under the law they gave 10% to God, then why wouldn't we at least want to do that and do more than that if we can? And I believe in it as a matter of if you're following the teachings of the Bible and the principles and you want to do it from the heart, not as a matter where we go around to every person and check their bank statements and throw them out of the church if they're not tithing. But if you say, well, I don't believe in tithing, you need to believe in something that is a systematic, regular way to give and give to the Lord's work. So all throughout the process, you can be giving if you're a Christian, and some people take his course that aren't even Christians. And so that anyway, it's not written in their tithe, but he does teach giving all throughout the process. So everybody got it, right? That's the end of the class. Just do this and you'll be fine. And actually with the class that he offers is called Financial Peace University, and then the YouTube channel. If you look at these seven and you remember them, you're going to know how he answers every question, and you're going to know the basic principles of following that particular system, but you can learn a lot more through listening to those classes, and he's not the only one that teaches personal finance, but I think it's a very good system. So tonight's lesson that we're going to talk about, the subject of working hard. When I worked in Plano, as I said, at my first job, there was an Indian man, and every time he saw me, he would say, Jack, are you working hard or are you hardly working? So as Christians, our idea should be that we're not just hardly working, barely enough to get by and be lazy as much as we can, but that we would be known for being hard workers and industrious in all of our endeavors. So anything we're going to talk about practical that has to do with budget and finance and giving, work and income is a massive part of that. Because if you don't work and you don't have an income, you're not going to be able to give, and it's going to be really hard to balance your budget if your income is lagging and suffering for a long time. So back to the Dave Ramsey thing, part of why I wanted to introduce you to his plan is that I'll say a lot of personal illustrations and stories that have come from just listening to his YouTube channel, where I like to listen to it again, not really to learn the system, but everybody calls with money questions, and that's where all the drama is, because money is intertwined with life. So people call the show and they say, well, I lent my brother money and now my brother didn't pay it back and I'm mad at him. So do I take my brother to court, or do I sue, or do I forgive it, or what do I do? And And that's where, you know, you teach all the sound principles about how loaning money to family isn't really wise in the first place, and you have to come down to praying about, is it worth burning this relationship forever or just forgetting the debt and moving on and learning not to do it again. But one time he had a call and a guy called in and he said, Dave, I need your help with trying to convince my wife to follow your plan. And he said, my wife is just, she listens, but then she's not on board with me. And he said, okay, what do you do for a living? I can't remember exactly what he said. This was years ago. He said, how much money do you make? And he said, I make $30,000 a year. And how many kids do you have? They had multiple little kids. And he said, so we live in an apartment. I make $30,000 a year, but my wife says we need cable for the kids to watch cartoons. And she just doesn't understand that if she would get in line with cutting the spending, that we would be okay. So the spending is the problem, Dave. The spending is the problem. And he said, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but in your situation, the spending is not really the problem. It's your income. Because yes, you can talk about, do you want to pay that $40 a month or whatever it would be for cable to watch cartoons, and is that wise? But your margins are so low. He said that no matter what you do to cut spending, you're going to struggle. So I want to talk about this biblically, and I don't want us to idolize money, but I do want us to see the practical side of saying, if we're going to spend 50 years of our life, 60 years of our life working anyway, then it would be wise for us to pray about ways that we can pursue earning a little bit more, because that doesn't make us idolaters. It doesn't make us lustful after riches. It can just be a wise thing to say, if I'm going to work really hard my whole life anyway, what can I learn to do that would get my income up, that would allow me to provide for my family and give to the Lord and save for the future and bless my neighbors and give to missions, which is part of what we want to do with our money in the first place. So another life advice show call that was money and finances, a lady called in and she was telling her story. And she said, I met my current husband during COVID on online dating, and he was a great guy. He was a fun guy. He had not a great job, but I believe that we were right for each other. We got married, and now we have two little kids that are under 4 years old. And she said, but the problem is, and what I didn't know about him before I got married, and what I'm dealing with now, is that he won't hold down a job. She said, he claims he applied to jobs. He says he's starting at a job, but then he goes and shows up, and I come home with the kids, and he's already at home, and I asked him what happened, and he said it didn't work out, and he'll get around to applying for other jobs when he's ready. So here's a lady in her mid-20s that married somebody, and I want to say a couple of things. Not making a lot of money doesn't make you less of a person. It doesn't make you have less character. It doesn't mean you shouldn't marry somebody who has less money. But if they're lazy and unwilling to work, that is a massive red flag that if you were to marry a person like that or tie yourself to an employee like that or start a business venture with someone who's lazy and unwilling to work, it can definitely be a curse on your life. And especially as the man in the relationship, it's a shameful thing that she said, so I'm working full time and I go pick up both the kids from daycare. He doesn't watch the kids. He doesn't clean the house. He claims he's going to apply for jobs and he doesn't, but he's been playing video games all day and he doesn't work. So I fear that throughout history, there's been some people who have a hyper-spiritual attitude about everything, but they have a very poor work ethic. Have you ever heard the saying that some people are so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good? What we mean by that is there might be somebody who always wants to talk about prayer and talk about the things of the Lord and be all spiritual, but when you have a practical endeavor and you're like, can you wipe down the table? And they come up with such a poor work ethic that they're all talk and they can't even work and do simple tasks. It's said derogatively of their mind is up in the clouds, but they're not focused on work and on what needs to be in front of them. And some people are called to a lifetime of doing jobs that are service-oriented, that's a calling, that will never make a lot of money. And that's absolutely okay. So I'm not telling you that making money is the most important thing. I'm not saying that playing video games is wrong. But if you play video games and you're not making money off of those video games and you're unwilling to go get a job, then that would make you lazy, if that makes sense. I just nod my head there because I know we have Jorge who's done some of that streaming and actually made money off of it. So I'm not talking about any type of a stereotype other than being too lazy and unwilling to go work hard for the Lord, for our family, or even to care for our needs. So we're not just, I don't know, applying for welfare and putting it on the state and on other people, but that if we're able-bodied, we should be able to work. So let's walk through a couple of scriptures in Thessalonians here, and then we'll talk about our outline. So in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, there's a brief note here that is that the church at Thessalonica had gotten all upside down on their eschatology, meaning their belief of end times events. And what we'll see is that basically they were in a panic, thinking that the Great Tribulation had already started. Then in the next chapter, he rebukes them for laziness. So we don't really know if it's connected completely, but the implication and the thinking from a lot of Bible teachers is that perhaps they were so focused on end times events and had gotten tricked and thought, well, Jesus is coming back. The tribulation's already started. What's the use if we work? And exactly. And they got rebuked by Paul because they were very spiritual about matters of end times prophecy, but they were lazy. So almost every single epistle that Paul writes, there's like 50 to 75% is this lofty language, soteriology, teaching about heaven, beautiful things. Some of them, like Thessalonians, is prophecy, and Philippians is unity and joy. And then somewhere 50 to 75% through the letter, he turns a corner and he's like real practical. This is how you get along in the church. This is how the family dynamic should operate. And in Thessalonians, he said, this is how you should work hard. So let me read you a little bit of chapter 2 to show you what I'm talking about. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together unto him. So remember Jesus is coming. Remember the church will be gathered unto Christ, but also be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by as letter from us, that the day of Christ is at hand. So it's online if you want to hear my whole 2-hour breaking down of the first part of this chapter and the way I believe it fits with end times. But my basic understanding is that he said, don't be shaken up, troubled, and panicked, either by a spirit or a word of revelation. And when he says a letter as from us, most people think he's referring to an actual fraudulent letter that someone had sent the church that claimed to be Paul, but was not Paul. And at the end, he'll say, now look at my signature. Look at how big it is where I sign. Don't ever read anything and think it was from me unless it contains this signature. And when he says that the day of Christ is at hand, I think he's talking about the day of the Lord, the day of wrath, the great tribulation. And when he says at hand, I believe here he's saying already begun. So he says, don't be freaked out and scared and think the great tribulation has already begun. Then he says, don't be deceived, and goes on to remind them that there's going to come a falling away, the great apostasy, and the man of sin, the Antichrist, is going to be revealed, and he'll oppose himself and sit in the temple of God and show that he is God. So he's saying, if you haven't seen the Antichrist show up yet, then you can't be in the tribulation. Remember, I told you these things? And then back to 1 Thessalonians 4. The church will be gathered up to the clouds. Then he starts talking about the day of the wrath. And every time he talks about the church, he says, we are going to be called up to meet the Lord in the clouds. And every time he talks about the wrath, he talks about them. So again, a separate subject, but I believe that through all of what he was saying, Paul said, you should know that you're going to be raptured and that the great tribulation can't be underway unless these things have been happening on a global scale. Remember ye not that when I was with you, I told you these things. So now to the heart of what I want to talk about in the next chapter, with that confusion of eschatology and the spiritual mindedness and the arguing about the tribulation and believing it was already underway in mind. 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 6. Now we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly, and not after the tradition which ye received of us. Now, when he says disorderly, now he's going to explain what he means by the people there who were claiming to be Christians, but were walking disorderly. Paul says, for yourselves know how ye ought to follow us. For we behave not ourselves disorderly among you, neither did we eat any man's bread for naught, but wrought with labor and travail night and day, that we might not be chargeable to any of you. So this is Paul, and I believe Timothy, and I can't remember Barnabas, who was with him on that particular trip to Thessalonica. But he says, remember that when we were there with you, we didn't just ask to eat your bread and then laze around all the time. He said, we labored and travailed, meaning we struggled. We worked hard at night and in the daytime so that we wouldn't be chargeable to any of you. And when they were planning churches in areas like this, they didn't even take financial support at all from those people they were starting the church among. Then he reminds them, not because we have not power, but to make ourselves an example unto you to follow us. So he really spells this out in 1 Corinthians 9. But the basic teaching Paul wanted these churches to remember is that God ordained, if someone's laboring full time in the gospel ministry and laboring to you, then you should give to support them. That's a good thing for the church, to support their ministers and to support missionaries. So Paul says we have the power to do that. We have the right to do that. But we went so far above and beyond to make sure you wouldn't look at us as just being after your money that we withheld teaching you about giving to our support at all until you had a chance to grow in the faith. And he actually says in one of the letters to the church at Corinth, he kind of wonders out loud, I wonder if I've done something wrong in not teaching you about giving sooner, because maybe those other churches that gave to support me at that time, I was kind of robbing them so that I wouldn't be chargeable to you. And then he said to those places, now I want you to give. Now I want you to step up. So some people have used these verses and these concepts to say, no missionary or no preacher, no minister should ever be supported by the church, even if the church has thousands of people. It's really not what Paul was doing or saying, but he was trying to church plant in areas where they were coming from a pagan Greek background. And those prophets were always evil people who were looking to rip them off and take their money and take advantage of them in other ways. So Paul said, let me go in, and rather than teaching these brand new converts, you're supposed to give so I can keep preaching. He said, I'm going to work at night. Does anybody know what he did for a while he was in Corinth? Tent maker with Aquila and Priscilla. He labored in a skill and a trade he had learned so that he could preach the gospel in the day and then he could work at night. So what Paul is saying is to the church at Thessalonica is, you guys really have no excuse for laziness because we gave you a great example. We were working hard. We could have asked you for offerings, but we said, let's not take a penny from them yet till they have a chance to grow in their faith and learn to trust us. And let's be a good example for you to follow. And he says, what did we do? We labored night and day. We worked hard. And the ministry itself is one of many different things that requires a lot of hard work. So you may be called to be a housewife or to be a missionary or whatever it is, but if you're a Christian and God has called you to do it, then your reputation should be you work really hard at it and you don't just be lazy and skate and ride on the back of everybody else's hard work. One pastor told the story that he was traveling in one of those summer groups, like either they would sing or go do vacation Bible school from his Bible college, and they showed up at this church where they were going to help for the week, and the pastor came out, who was not that old, was a healthy-bodied man, and he said, okay, you guys are here, we got some things we'll need to work on later, he said, but not yet. He said, and by the way, what time do you guys take your afternoon nap? Now, I'm not opposed to taking a nap. Sometimes when I'm out there in the heat, and I come home and I'm just drained from 108, anywhere from 20 minutes on, if I rest, I feel better. So I get plenty of sleep, which is what the science tells us, probably 7 or 8 hours. For most people, you need to be healthy. I don't think you're lazy if you sleep or if you take a nap. But the pastor said, as a college student, he thought it was a little bit strange that the first question the grown man asked the college workers was, what time do we need to schedule in your nap before we get to work? And he said it wasn't just that he said that, but the church, when he went, was in a terrible state of disarray, and it wasn't cleaned, and things weren't organized. And when he got up to preach his lesson, you could tell he hadn't worked very hard at preparing for his lesson. So Paul said that the Lord had placed him into the work of the ministry, and the word he uses for the work of the ministry means a menial labor, a hard task, as you would go and move and carry bricks. He used the exact same word for the ministry.
So whatever it is that we do, if it's a job where we sit inside or whether we go outside or if we're a missionary or a pastor or a housewife, hard work is really important and it's actually required of us by God. So verse 10, "For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat." This verse would take care of a lot of different things as far as abuse of a welfare state. It's a very simple thing. As you'll see, Paul says in the next verses, that wasn't just Paul's rule. That was a command directly from the Lord himself. The principle being, if you like to eat and you have an able body, you should be required to work. Now in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, he also had reminded this same church, support the weak and comfort the feeble-minded. The words there literally indicate give support and take care of to those who are physically impaired and unable to work. And I thought of that verse, and at Christmas time, I thought of that story of A Christmas Carol, the Scrooge story. Has anybody seen the adaptation of that? There's a whole lot of different ones, old, modern, and Muppets and all that. But it just stuck my heart one year how that Scrooge was able to see in the fictional story the ghost of, I don't know, whatever was showing him what could have been and what will happen in the future. I think it was the future one. And he visited the house of Bob Cratchit, the poor man who worked for him that had the little menial bookkeeping job that didn't pay much and a whole bunch of kids, like 7 or 8 kids. And when Tiny Tim had passed away, the whole family was robbed of joy and was weeping and was sad. And Tiny Tim in the story was a boy that couldn't go out and do work. He couldn't go get a job. He couldn't help clean the house. He was a little bit simple in his mind, but he was on crutches. He was crippled. He couldn't work. And early on in the movie, I know I'm talking about Christmas movies. Like I said, y'all just give me the grace that this is going to be a long series. I don't want to rush through an outline. And what I'm saying is we don't take this and look down as Christians or as a society about people who can't work or people who are disabled. What a terrible thing it is that many people schedule elective abortions when they find out their baby's going to have Down syndrome. It's a horrible thing and a terrible sin before God to rob the world and your family of joy that could be brought in to the world just because someone has a disability. God would not want us to do that. So Tiny Tim, early on in the movie, they came to Scrooge, the rich, grumpy man who wasn't willing to give of any of his money and was a character of the way we shouldn't be as a tightwad and unwilling to give. And they said, "Give to the poor." He said, "I'm not going to give to the poor." And they said, "But if you don't give, they're going to die. It's wintertime. They'll starve. There's no jobs for them." And he said, "Well, if they're going to die, then let them die and decrease the surplus population." And that just stuck in my mind that in the beginning of the movie, he's saying, if you can't produce for society, then you're a drag on society. You can die. The idea of a surplus population is we hear that repeated today through the excuse of global warming or eugenics, or even college professors will say, well, the world's overpopulated, so we need to just start going to the disabled and to the mentally challenged who don't really know what's going on and the old people and just euthanize them and kill them and then we'll have more resources and we won't destroy the planet. And the science of that is just, it's garbage on its face, the whole the Marvel thing, the Thanos, you know, we got to kill half the people because there's not enough resources. If someone had just explained to him that all of that was garbage in the first place, that would have saved a lot of trouble because God has given us a planet with plentiful resources if we will work what is there. And in general, more people are a blessing to an economy and a society, not less people. That's why all around the world and coming up soon in America, people are not valuing the family and having children. Like God said, children are a blessing. And the birth rate is falling below replacement rate. In some of these places like Germany and China, there's like a crisis where they're going 80 years from now, where are we going to be? Now everybody will give you government money if you have babies because their very society is going to be just like,
eradicated or contracted, severely diminished, because they don't have enough people. So I don't know about you, but when I look at the map, I see room for plenty of more people to come. Look at Montana. Look at sections of the world where there's rich resources. Or we could lay a pipeline to put water there. And if we would let more people come, it would actually be a blessing. And God's going to provide for those resources. So Scrooge goes from saying, let those people die so we don't have too much population, to then seeing the utter heartbreak of a family who lost a little disabled boy who couldn't produce in the way he thought a valuable person in society should produce. So please don't think I'm talking down about people who are poor or who work menial jobs or work and labor away, but especially people who are disabled. Those people, God said we should support the weak. But this verse very clearly teaches that if someone comes to you or to the church and they're able and capable of working, and there's plenty of jobs available, and they refuse to go get a job, that person should not be supported by our giving, because you're supporting laziness and sin. So Christians are always put in a bit of a catch-22, where we want to help with our finances, but if we're not careful, we'll enable greediness or sin. So somebody in the church, somebody who's a Christian, somebody whoever, like I said, both of their legs are broken and their kids are going to starve, and we can organize giving them some food and a store of rice and beans that they can boil so that the kids don't starve. That's a good thing. But someone who's able-bodied comes in from off the street and says, yeah, I'm having a hard time. If I hand them $300 in cash, it's possible I'm supporting laziness. It's also possible I just gave a drug dealer $300 and this guy's going to be out of pocket for the next 48 hours till he sleeps off his drugs. So we got to be wise in the way even that we give, and make sure that our good heart of wanting to take care of people doesn't lead us to doing something that's actually sinful and harmful. Thank you, Lord, for reminding me of this, because this isn't in my notes either. But the same guy I showed you the slide, the financial teaching from Dave Ramsey, he said that this was decades ago. He was involved in the Tennessee area with a kind of a mega church, a good-sized church. And they went to him and said, we always have people coming and asking for money, and we need a better system of making sure we're not just giving to lazy people, but we don't want to turn people away. What do we do? So he created a system where if you would go out back and rake leaves for 2 hours, you would get a $100 gift card to the grocery store. And this was like 30 years ago, okay? So I know you're thinking, oh, $100, that's enough to barely get, what, eggs and milk and bread. But that would buy you a lot of really good food that would feed you and your family. And he said, in all the years we offered that, not one person who said I'm hungry ever would go work, but plenty of people cussed us out and said, you're not real Christians, and stormed off to try and go mooch off of the next people. So this was the command of God. If any is not willing to work, then neither should he eat. One pastor in Florida said, I set up my deacons and I said, let's keep soup cans in the kitchen. If they come in and say we're hungry, we give them a soup can. And if they need more, say, set up an appointment with our deacons, bring your financials, bring your work history. We'll try to teach you how to do a budget and see if we can find you a job. And then we'll see if you need help. And guess how many people follow up on that appointment? Nobody does. So this, again, is off topic, but what we've tried to do, especially since the beginning when we're struggling to get back on our feet, we will give if people in the church we know are having a hard time. I've driven with people and filled their gas tank and done things like that. But right now we have two massive files of food pantries and rent assistance and homeless shelters that we give people. And I guarantee you there's resources around Plano with a lot more to help people than we do. So we genuinely want to help them, but that kind of helps weed out this people walk in off the street and ask for money, and you have no way to vet. Are they actually willing to work? Are they actually just going to buy drugs? There was one guy that seemed very healthy riding his bike all around, and it was a 3 to 5 year gap, and he showed back up. Same story as he'd came in before. So you're going, is there that many places that he just makes the rounds endlessly? And like I said, we have done and will continue, Lord willing, a lot to do to help people who are in need and give to these other ministries that support them. But we have to remember this principle. We can't enable greedy and lazy people, or we're actually sinning by, again, what's the whole point of what we're talking about? Not really money or our wants with money, but taking good care of God's stuff.
So your money is actually God's stuff. The church's bank account is God's stuff, and we're going to answer to God for how we managed his stuff, and we want to be wise. For we hear, Paul continues, that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. So disorderly means they're disobeying. Working not at all, they're just being lazy. And the word for busybody literally means that wanting to run back and forth and tell stories and tell gossip. And when we have too much time on our hands and we're not busy with work, well, we can't sleep. A lot of people have trouble with sleep. I'm not saying you're lazy, but have you tried working really hard? Because some people don't have a schedule. They don't have work. They're not applying themselves. And if we're idle, it leads to a lot of opportunities to sin and to do foolish things and to fill our time with things that are not profitable. So the saying is that an idle mind is the devil's workshop. That's not a scripture quote, but it is a scriptural principle. And the verse in Proverbs says that a child who is left to himself will bring his mother shame. So if you want your children to shame you, leave them alone. And don't keep up with what they're doing. They're naturally bent that way. And as sinners, we are naturally bent where if we're idle and we don't work, it leads to things like this busybody running around and telling stories and that type of thing. Now in 1 Timothy, which we'll look at a couple of verses here, and this will definitely be split into a two-week study here tonight, so we'll wrap up in a couple of minutes after we get through point one and see if anybody has any questions or things to add. But in Timothy, it's talking about widows and should the church care for widows. And it's, Paul says, if a younger woman were to have her husband die and be a widow, what's his first advice for her? Does anybody remember? He says, let her marry, bear children, and learn to guide the house. Why? He says, because if not, if she's given fully to the care of the church, as like a nun would be at a very young age, it's going to lead to busybodying, tattletaling, being a gossip, and eventually being dissatisfied with that life and lusting after a more normal life. Okay, so not working led them to be busybodies. Now them that are such, we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ that with quietness they work and eat their own bread. I love this verse and I love simple verses in the Bible. One of them says, pray that you may live a quiet and a peaceable life. I feel like I don't have that as much as I would like, but God's satisfied with us living a life that is quiet, that is at peace. And this verse says, working, making enough money to buy our own bread so that we don't have to go to other people and say, would you support me while we're not actually willing to work? But ye brethren, be not weary in well-doing. And if any man obey not our word by this epistle, note that man and have no company with him that he may be ashamed. So he's referring to the whole epistle, and he applies this in other places towards people who are living in fornication that aren't willing to repent. But here he applies it very specifically after just having said, separate from the disorderly, those who are lazy, those who won't work. And then he says, have no company with them that they may be ashamed. So Paul was pretty hardcore, but he said, if these people refuse the rebukes and they continue on in laziness and want you to support them, then don't just go hang out with them and fellowship and be friends like you normally would, like nothing is wrong, but let them feel ashamed. Not for the purpose of shame, but those things are always for the purpose that we would repent and be restored to right living and to fellowship. So I'm at 7:49. Let me read you a handful of selected scriptures, give you a closing couple of stories, and then I think about 5 minutes I'll move to see any other questions people would want to share here tonight. Okay, so number one, hard work is commanded by God. Hard work is commanded by God. We just read 2 Thessalonians 3:10. If you're not willing to work, then you shouldn't be allowed to eat. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse number 3, this was Paul's instruction to the local church for how to care for widows. And he says, honor widows that are widows indeed. And there was actually very strict qualifications that they needed to be Christian and have lived a good life of service to the Lord. And then he also says, but if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. So part of what you'll see here in this
context that Paul is saying part of the principle of the church supporting the widows would be that they've actually lived a good life of character, not that they sinned their whole life, and then that they come say, oh, well, the church take care of me financially. But he also says, don't look at the church and think, well, I give to the church so the church can take care of grandma who's 88 and can't work. I already gave to the church. No, Paul said, you take care of your own if you're able to do so and give to the church to support the work of the Lord, because the church is not primarily a social institution, it's a spiritual one. So again, hyper-spiritual. Some people could say, well, I gave to the church. The church can take care of my mom when she's old and decrepit. But that would be wrong, and that would be violating the principles that even Christ said when he said to the Pharisees, stop giving people loopholes to not care for their parents. It's their job to care for their parents if their parents aren't able to do so. And again, we'll probably come back to that because that's a whole nother conversation. What if you have a parent who's healthy that's not willing to work? What if, you know, you can't care for them? There's things we could do to help love and support, that it's not just a command, do whatever your parent says, even if you're an adult. But there is clear biblical teaching that if you have a parent who's unable to work and the state can't help care for them through our tax dollars and you can, you need to make sure that your parents don't starve in the same way you looked after your little baby and made sure your parents, made sure your babies didn't starve. God gives you responsibility for both of that. And the word there for nephews, this is a total side note, but it kind of means descendants. So the oldest English dictionary will say nephew can refer to nephews and nieces, or it can actually refer to grandchildren. It was an old English way of saying descendants. So that's kind of what we think he's saying here. You have a child, you have a grandparent. Again, not like a mistake, but just a different way they would have used the word in the 1600s than we would use it now. The principle is take care of those for whom you are responsible for and not just pawn them off on the church. Then he says, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. An infidel just means here an unbeliever, like the pagans of that Greek society. This again is very, very strong language from Paul, the Lord's apostle. You're not willing to provide, and it does say his in the masculine. If you're not willing to work to provide, then you have denied the faith of God. You've denied the faith of the New Testament, and you're worse than an unbeliever. The implication being even the unbelievers don't refuse to work and provide for their kids and for their home. I'll say this as a side note too that we may come back to. I don't think anyone should feel guilt or pressure in the day and age that we're living, that if the wife is able to work and contribute and it works for your family, I don't think you're violating the law of God. I think there's principles there of the wife being a keeper at home. The word keeper means as an innkeeper. So her heart's at home. She's looking to keep it up, make sure that it runs well. But I don't believe that there's a scriptural forbidding of the wife helping to make income, but the implication is that the main responsibility first falls on the man, and if he's taking his hands off and unwilling to work when he's healthy and his family suffers, that God's going to judge him extremely harshly. And I say that only to say, in our day and age and context, I don't want to teach in a way that makes people feel guilty or bad for the way they're carrying out their finances, because things are very tough. Our country continues to follow very poor financial principles, which is part of what we'll talk about at some point, that the way our government handles the money is causing people to suffer and things to cost more. And so among some people who are so extreme, saying, well, the wife should never work, all she should do is be at home, is you've got an economy where the man may be struggling to get his income up and need time to grow, and the other people are being extreme, saying, well, she can't work at all, that's not biblical, but you have to get your income up this high before you can get married. And then people are sitting around for decades plus not getting married when they could have gotten married and had children in a world that isn't perfect. So there's a lot of things there you'll have to pray about for your home, and it very well may be worth sacrificing, where if you have kids, the wife can work part-time, or to where, you know, the dad can care for the kid if the mom is doing part of it. We can talk about those scriptures more if you want to, but I don't think we should feel bad about being a two-income household if that's what God leads us to do. And I don't think that's wrong or sinful. I would just say pray for God's will for your situation
and don't do what a lot of Americans do, where a kid is in daycare or public school 40 hours a week, they come home and they're in front of a TV the rest of the day, and you throw them in bed and you're treating them like they're just something to keep out of the way. Value your kids, value your marriage, but do what God leads you to do wisely in your home to provide. And some ladies own their own businesses or work from homes while they're watching the kids, or part-time jobs, all of that. I am just telling you from my heart, I'd rather see people get married, like God says is a good thing, and do what they need to do to survive and work towards a good future, than to take the attitude of, well, if he's not making $100,000 a year, then they're not allowed to get married and stuff like that. I'm off on a lot of side tangents, but I think they're good, and I think they fit. So I think they're good. That's my decision on my side tangents here tonight. About five more verses. Let me see if I can read them without commenting much. If a man or woman that believeth hath widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. So again, don't just pawn your family member off on the church. Give to the church and care for your mom if you're actually able to do so when she's at that age where that's the way it has to be done. Ecclesiastes says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with thy might. Do it vigorously. Be known as a hard worker. Colossians 3, whatsoever ye do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men. Knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ. I need to remember to put the Peter scriptures in here next week, because Peter talks specifically about our employers and how we are to work for them as if it was for the Lord, even if we're suffering, and to remember God will bless us for that. But here's the principle. Who do we serve? We serve the Lord. So if I go to work at... what's Janet's hospital? I don't remember. Southwestern. Or Medical City McKinney. Or the post office. Or Texas Instruments. I'm not really going there to serve that company. I'm going there to serve the Lord. Because everything we do as if we were doing it directly for Him. Whether we think people deserve our best or not. If we say, Lord, I will suffer persecution on the job if need be, but I will work as if I'm working for You, I promise you God's going to take care of you. And if you feel like I work hard and everybody else gets lazy and it's not fair, there may be some things you need to do to not let yourself be taken advantage of. I'm not saying that's wrong. But I promise you, if you just work hard, the Lord's going to bless you. And He's going to give you a future beyond you having to compare, well, that person's getting away with being lazy when I'm not. Genesis 2:15, the Lord took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. So when is the fall? Genesis 3 is the first sin. Before sin ever entered the world, God said, Adam, let me give you a productive task. Name all of the animals. And before sin, He said, go to the garden and dress it and keep it. So I refuse to believe that heaven will be a place of inactivity. What did the cartoon show? You're sitting on a cloud playing the harp and that's all you do. And people say, well, heaven sounds boring. And I want to study heaven more than I have and be able to talk more articulately about it than I can now throughout just the size of it, the way the book of Revelation describes it. It's all fascinating. But I refuse to believe heaven's going to be a place where we sit on a couch and stare at a wall and get bored, because it's going to be God's perfect creation. And like the book of Genesis, I'm not saying we're going to have jobs and we have to get up early and we're going to be tired. The curse of work was that the ground is going to be hard and you're going to have to labor and toil in the heat of the day and struggle through. But inactivity was never God's ideal. So productivity and tasks and doing things, I believe, are even going to be a part of heaven. So whatever you do, it's important that you learn to be a hard worker. You have a job, you need to work. You want to start a business? There's no such thing as real passive income. You're going to have to work hard at your business. If you're a housewife raising children, you're going to have to work hard at that. Or else you will in some ways be a curse upon your family, not again for health or what you're not able to do. But if you're just a lazy person, that doesn't bring blessing. It brings struggles and burdens to your family and to those around you. The old story goes that there was a lady that her husband got home one day and the housewife was in bed eating chocolate and all of the kids were fighting each other and permanent markering the living room and out in the yard with their clothes off. And he went to her room and said, "What happened today?" And she said, "You know how you're always saying to me, what do you do all day anyway? What do you do all day anyway?" He said, "Well, today I just didn't do it. So that way you could see what it's like when I actually don't do what I am supposed to do in taking care of the house." So that's just kind of a funny story to say, being a full-time housewife or mom, it's not like that's not work, okay? Whatever we do, God wants us to apply ourselves, and certainly when it comes to ministry, to pastors, to missionaries, teaching a class, doing a job for the Lord, singing a song, cleaning up, building a playground, whatever it is, we want to do it right, and we want to work hard because that honors the Lord. We had one supervisor at our work that came early in the morning. He was very lazy. He goofed off. He talked. He would, all the women that were under him would do them the special favors and flirt with them all day and then turn to the guys and give them the worst jobs. And he got to go home at 3 o'clock no matter what. But the guy who had to stay till the mail got delivered had to stay till the mail got delivered. And he would always be so mad because the guy who was there in the morning didn't care. So he had to stay and wait for us to clean up the mess. And I'll never forget, early one morning, somebody ran up to his desk and he said, "We got three routes down. Nobody's here. It's a heavy day. We're all going to have to work extra. You got three people sitting at home. Pick up the phone and call them. They need to come to work." And the only supervisor on duty said, "That's not my job." In other words, I don't care. We don't have enough employees. It's not my job to call somebody and say, "Come to work," when he was the only manager responsible. And we suffered underneath his leadership quite often. Why? Because he was lazy and he didn't care about doing a good job. So that certainly should not be our testimony as Christians. If we're a Christian, whether we're working in a church context or whether we're working at McDonald's, we should be known for being a hard worker, honest, ethical, and reliable in all that we do. We've got three more points we'll cover next week, and then we'll go over the last page as career tips. I just have them down as bullet points. I didn't print that page, did I? Okay, that's actually good. Y'all don't have that one. You'll have to come back next week to get it. I think I just printed the first two, and we'll talk about some practical tips about if we want to get ahead in our career, things we can consider that are wise, but at the same time, not just being lustful of money as if that was the most important thing. So I don't have a list of study questions or anything. If nobody wants to say anything, that's fine. But we're 2 minutes past eight. Would anybody like to ask a question, tell a story, add a prayer request, or anything at all? Doesn't look like it. All right, that's good. That means I don't have to answer any questions. So let me see. If anybody needs anything, please let me know after the service. Next week is the day before the 4th of July, so I know some of y'all will be out of town. Like James probably will be out of town. I think Joe is too. But I think we're going to be here, unless I were to hear from all of you tonight that everybody's out of town. I think we're taking the long-term plan of, if there's a severe weather event, or if it's a major holiday like Christmas Day itself, or falls on the 4th of July and everybody would not be able to have their family plans, we may postpone the Bible study then. But we'll be here next week, so I hope everybody is able to as well. Noel, my brother, would you close us in a word of prayer here tonight, if you don't mind, sir?